Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hi everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale, I'm a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to the legendary critic Molly Haskell. She is a writer with many books who, along with her husband Andrew Saris, has marked American film criticism for many, many decades, and it's a real honour and pleasure to talk to her. If you enjoy the episode, please remember to like and subscribe. You can leave a review as well, that really helps a lot. But before you do any of that, enjoy the conversation. Finishing your, frankly, my dear book today, I can hear that accent. I can hear that Virginia, trace of a Virginia accent there.
That's because I haven't woken up. I mean, I always have it, but I think I have it a little more now than when I'm fully awake.
With the coffee takes the edge off.
Yeah.
Last week, I interviewed Janine Basinger.
I saw that, yeah.
And she was saying very nice things about you.
Oh, I feel the same way about her. She's been fantastic. Yeah. And I never see her, but I'm very aware of her.
It just seems like there are these female voices in film writing, you know, yourself, Janine, you know, and going back to Pauline Kael, and that are really vital voices that feel as more relevant today than ever before.
Well, thank you. There are a lot today. I mean, I can't get over how many. I mean, there's so many good film writers. That one of the problem is there are just so many now. When I was, Pauline and I, well, Janine wasn't writing for a regular news outlet, but when we were writing, it's one of the things I'm writing my memoir about. The 60s and 70s was such a different time, obviously for lots of reasons, but there were newspapers and magazines, and there weren't so many. We were just discovering. You know, it's sort of the time of reassessing American films, and the New York Film Festival was beginning, and New York had a huge number of retrospective theaters, and there were film societies were beginning on campuses. So it was really the big burst of cinephilia. And it was like we were all talking about the same films. Now, of course, it's just wildly diffuse and dispersed, and so many countries are represented, so many minorities are represented. It's just fast and sort of different age groups being appealed to. So it's just a whole different cinematic landscape. But yeah, I think there were other women writing. Let's see, Joy Boyum at Wall Street Journal. There weren't many, but there were. Well, for one thing, like at the newspapers, film wasn't being taken that seriously. So women at newspapers got to write about it. It wasn't a big deal, you know. So there were a few women, not particularly feminist, but women. But now, of course, they have their own blogs and they have their own their own bylines here, there, and everywhere. I wish I could just even keep up with it. It's just you know, there's just almost too much of it. And also, of course, people write at greater length now because they don't have a magazine or newspaper format to adhere to. So you have not only more people, but more words, more quantity and quality.
I remember in England, the first film critic that I ever read with any regularity as a sort of boy growing up was a Sunday Times critic called Dillis Powell.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It was great. And again, I mean, I don't remember, it's so long ago since I read her, but it was probably just that tradition almost coming over from theatrical criticism of just sort of well-written, solid, you know, critique.
That's the other thing. One of the other things that was changing in this period I'm writing back, all of a sudden it became very different. Well, yes, it was being at first in the Times that Bosley Crowther, who was there for years and years and years, wrote about film as if he were writing about a play. I mean, the writer, and you know, you just went in order, the performances, the this and the that, and you would never put your personal, you know, you would never say I, use the pronoun I. Then all of a sudden it was personal, and it was this sort of recognition that there was no such thing as really objective criticism, especially with movies. You know, we had all been formed in a very personal way by the movies we saw. We had inherent biases that we recognized and therefore use the pronoun I. So all of a sudden you get these voices that are very distinctive voices in film criticism. And also then you get lots and lots of arguments too, because there really hadn't been a body of sort of accredited film criticism. You know, there wasn't a canon, there wasn't a sort of playbook. It was just all loose out there. It was all kind of the Wild West in terms of how you could write about it, what films were important, whether you should call them films or movies, you know, middlebrow, lowbrow, sort of accrediting forms that had previously been considered disreputable, were becoming creditable. Like, this was sort of a little later, but anyway, in the 70s, science fiction and horror film, which had just been B movies before, were being given A movie treatment. So everything was kind of shifting and changing, and it was exciting and contentious.
And talking about that formative period when we all have our, you know, we're like ducklings, you know, breaking out of the egg, and the first thing we see imprints us, that's what we're going to follow for the rest of our lives. What were those formative experiences of cinema for you?
Well, I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, and it was not, there was, at that time, most big cities had one foreign film theater, and the rest was just whatever Hollywood, first run Hollywood. There were no revivals, no reflectives. So I wasn't exactly, I was a late blooming cinephile, but the film that really kind of shook me up was Diabolique, the Clouseau film, which took place in a boarding school. I was going to a sort of girls' school, so I knew what that kind of fetid atmosphere was like. And it just blew my mind. It was so dark, and there was this sort of evil and sophisticated. It was sort of not like anything I'd ever seen. And so I was already kind of interested in for France and French culture. And so that movie just, it was a whole different ball game as far as movies were concerned. And I think that was one of the things that made me want to go live in Paris, which I did after I graduated from college. And there, I guess it's interesting because the man I would marry, Andrew Saris, the film critic, was there at the same time, but we didn't know it. We would meet only a couple of years later. But we were both living in West Bank hotels, Left Bank hotels, and probably going to some of the same movie theaters on the Left Bank and seeing the same things, which were not just French films, but, you know, American, because this was a period of the Cahiers and the reassessment of American films. I mean, it started with the French because they had seen the films had been held up during the Second World War, and then a whole lot of them were sort of opening at once in the Cinematheque and other places. So they saw all these films at once from directors like Hawks, and the obvious ones are sort of Hawks at Ford, but all, some of the other directors too, Peckinpah, all these directors. And they didn't see films in high versus low. They just saw all of cinema was equally interesting. And they loved the American films, and they began the process of kind of assessing and evaluating them in a taxonomy. And then Andrew was influenced by this when he did his taxonomy of American film directors. So that was the period when it was just, you were just learning, you know, you were just seeing things, a lot of films at once, seeing Brest, I mean, just seeing these great French directors who were making their, who were coming out now, René and Bresson and the Nouvelle Vague, Truffaut, Godard, all of that. And it was just so exciting. And then with American films too. And of course, there were fights because Andrew was an auteurist and Pauline Kael hated the auteur theory. So they were just squabbling in print and saying nasty things about each other. Pauline was nastier. He was the nastier one. I have to say that. Anyway, and so some people, because I was just looking at this book that came out at that time. It's called Favorite Movies. A guy named Philip Nobley put it together. And Pauline's not in it. She has better things to do or something. But it has a lot of interesting pieces by different critics of the time. David Denby, Stephen Farber, Andrew and I are both in it, some of the English critics, and a favorite film. And in the beginning, he asked everybody, why are they so argumentative? And they say it, that's what I've said. It's just because it hasn't been, this whole, the canon hasn't been hammered out yet. And then he asked them, why are they so vituperative? And one person is anonymous. I'm sure it must be Manny Farber. Although if it were Manny, I don't think he would have been anonymous. He said, because they're all assholes.
Well, he's honest.
That's the way he saw it. Anyway, everybody but him was an asshole.
It sounds like Twitter before Twitter.
Thank God there was no Twitter then. Oh my God, it would have ended it up. Oh my God, it's enough. Yeah, it was like that. And it was also like blog. I mean, they were closer, the reviews were closer to blogs than to the conventional review too. Mm. In the personal dimension of it.
How long were you in Paris for? Because that must have been amazing, sort of being in Paris, seeing movies, and then coming out of the movie and being in Paris, you know?
It was fantastic. It was just wonderful. And I didn't have the framework of Cahiers or anything like that to go by. But it was, I mean, seeing the Truffauts and Brest and Godard for the first time and just knowing how great they were. Of course, I didn't have anybody to talk to about it. That was frustrating. But I was just smitten. And I mean, all of them with Romare Chabrol, I think they're my first loves in many ways. And it's always interesting. Another thing that one of the sort of, this is not quite related, but it's one of the areas of disagreement of Pauline and Andrew was that Pauline said, I guess, I don't know if this is true or not, but she maintained that she never wanted to see a film twice. I mean, she felt that the first experience was the important one, and that's the one she wanted to give her readership. But for Andrew and for me as well, I think one of the joys, extreme joys of movie going and movie loving is seeing things again and reassessing things and seeing how they look at in different periods and whether they hold up. And, you know, your feelings shift and the movie scene, of course, the movie's still the same, but it seems to be slightly different in a different era and all of that. So I think that's part of what a different approach to film criticism. One is just I think the reviewer, the daily reviewer, of course, is the, you go with your first response. You know, that's what the readership of a newspaper wants, the first response. But I mean, today, I don't think anyone does that. I mean, I read Manola Dargis or somebody who writes in the Times or, you know, for a large audience, and they all acknowledge having seen something twice, you know. And I think, and also in a way, movies may be more meant to be seen twice now. So I may say Kubrick or somebody like that. Anyway, just different approaches. And they were all jostling with each other during that period.
It's so funny having those rules as well. It's always, I kind of admire it to some degree, but I also suspect they're always there to be broken. There's no, you know, what's the point in having that rule if you're not going to break it?
No. Well, how can you resist? I mean, some movie that you've loved, you're not going to see it again. My God, I don't get it.
You know, why eat one chip? I mean, I've never met anyone who's eaten one pizza. You know, you either eat pizzas all the time or you don't know they exist. There's no middle ground.
Well, I guess you could say that they're different flavors, but they're not that many different flavors. So, I mean, yeah, that's right. Exactly. This one is better than anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I also often think that repeat watching makes me kind of a little bit more critical of films as well, because I sort of think to myself, well, this reminds me of The Searchers. I could just be watching The Searchers, you know, that's
yeah, that too. I think you start to see more, if you, the more you see the sort of overlapping influences in film, and the more you see some director and some other director. I think one of the things too that Andrew always emphasized, and Marty Scorsese is doing that, says this all the time, is how I think people are not, especially then, and I think to some extent now too, that audiences, general audiences, did not, they listened more than they looked. They were just, they were very attuned to the dialogue. They could always criticize the dialogue, but they had no clue about sort of directorial choices, about cuts, I mean, you know, editing or, you know, camera position, any of those things. And Andrew taught, of course, for many years. And that was the thing he would talk in his class. He said, well, you know, you have this first response, which is almost childlike, where you just, where those are real people up on the screen and you just enter into it uncritically. Then if you're in a class or if you are a critic, you start taking it apart. And that's an awkward period. And because you lose that immediacy that you had before. So you understand, you'd have to count the cuts, how many cuts are there, get familiar with tracking shots and how they're used, the length of focus, all of those things. So you take it apart. And that's a time when, as I say, it's awkward and uncomfortable. And then, though, hopefully, you put it all together again, and it's just a much, much richer experience. So you get sort of the first response, because you're still responding to those stars, you always are, to the people on the screen, and yet you can understand some intention, and you get nuances that you might not have gotten if you'd never kind of appreciated film style.
There's always that thing of, like, I think, you know, on social media, and a lot of people approaching film at the moment are sort of they're a little bit in the thrall of their enthusiasms, and that's great. Enthusiasm is good, but you've got to describe why you like something and why something is good and why something isn't good, why something isn't working for you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can't just get in the mood of it and sort of applaud it, and I mean, that's a great response if you feel that way, but then break it down. Yeah,
absolutely. And if it's good enough, it'll survive criticism, it'll survive analyze.
Yeah, it'll survive and probably look even more interesting.
I've also read From Reverence to Rape, your, you know, landmark study, I would say, the role of women, how Hollywood is portrays women, and it's such an eye-opening study, even after all these years, because this was obviously published first time in the 80s, I imagine.
Oh, 70s, early 70s.
Okay, I'm reading the revised edition, so I think it might go up to the mid 80s.
Yeah, right.
So what was the inception of that book?
Well, I was the women's, as it was called then, the women's movement was sort of getting off the ground. And I had always had a kind of, I don't think that I was wildly, well, it was just, let's just, I had read, people were reading things like Betty Friedan. I had read Simone de Beauvoir. That was the one, The Second Sex. That was the one that sort of stirred my feminist juices. And so the women's movement, everybody was forming sort of consciousness raising sessions and there was sort of activity trying to get more women placed at the Times and this, that, and the other. And so I thought, well, what about taking a look at the way women are treated in film? I mean, that was the sort of my feminist instinct to look at film that way. So that was really the beginning of it. And it just, I guess I had started writing, reviewing for The Voice under Andrew. And then I went to other places, but I was first at The Voice, and I started reviewing from a feminist perspective. I mean, I would review something like Butch Cassidy, and I would say, what's with all these buddy films? Where are the women? Because it happened to be that there weren't very many women. It was a great period for sort of the new independent cinema of directors like, you know, Scorsese and Milos Forman, Coppola and De Palma and all these people. But what happened, because they were getting away from the studio system, they weren't obligated to use women. I mean, the studio system had women on an equal level and equal pay with men, and they assumed that they were making films for women audiences. Now, that is no longer the case at all, even now, actually. But so they definitely wanted to appeal to women, whereas when these young Turks started making personal films, they felt no obligation to either include women or to appeal to women. And I'm not saying that the films don't have a universal appeal, but they just weren't at all women oriented. So this struck me as, isn't this interesting? Here we are in this period of discussing equal pay and equal rights for women, and yet they're being squeezed out of movies. So that was kind of the trigger, I guess, that sort of sent me into the past to look. And it was just so much fun to do. It was a little bit hard because the movies weren't available the way they are today, the movies from the past. But I had Andrew, who could remember every plot of every movie, and he would start telling me there would be what we now call melodrama, like a woman's film with with Margaret Sullivan and Charles Boyer or something, and he would start doing the plot, and I would start, he would start crying, and I would start crying because it was such a weepy. But anyway, that's how I got some of my material, anyway, my information.
I mean, what you present is a real sweep of the whole history of cinema from The Silence on. And what I found, one of the bits that I found sort of the hardest to take was your characterization of my beloved Laurel and Hardy as misogynistic. And I was like, oh, no, please, no.
Oh, that was harsh. I love them too. I would never do that. Now, I think you do this when you're doing something that's at all polemical. You maybe just overstate it sometimes. And yeah, I think I did overstate that because, I mean, that's what they are. I mean, in a way, they are male and female together. I mean, they're kind of, androgynous in their own way. Anyway, they're wonderful. And W.C. Fields, of course, I would never want to have a cinema without W.C. Fields either.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And Keaton and Chaplin.
Keaton is just, my God, I've come back and he's one that I just watch again with increased appreciation every time I see him. He's just, and Chaplin, of course, too. They are cinema in a way.
During the pandemic, I teach at university in Italy, and during the pandemic, I would give the students like films to watch, and we watched Sherlock Jr. and we talked about it afterwards, and it was so funny because they all said, "I thought I was going to hate this black and white silent film," made way before my time, and practically everybody said, "This is my new favorite film of all time."
Really? It's one of my, I put that on my 10, the Sight and Sound 10 favorite.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, absolutely.
So much. Yeah. There's something I would say about that, but I've forgotten what it was. Anyway. Oh, I know what it was. Yeah. So Pee Wee Herman just died, and he had just gone by my radar completely. So I thought, well, I've got to watch a Pee Wee Herman movie just so I know who he is, because he was not my era for television or anything. So I watched Pee Wee Herman's Great Adventure, and I did find, I was drawn to him in certain ways. I think he was talented, but in the end, he has this whole segment where he goes through whatever studios, the Universal and Warner Brothers, through the studio back lot and all the sets. And it just reminded me so much of Sherlock Jr. and of Keaton doing his own acrobatics. Whereas Pee Wee Herman, you see that he's always being cut. I mean, he doesn't pretend to do it himself, but all the kind of the physical comedy is he's not, it's not him. I mean, just, it's a very, what he does is very limited compared to what Keaton does.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, no one is comparable to Keaton. I don't think even Laurel and Hardy, I think, had their own stuntmen and doubles though. They weren't.
Yeah. No, nobody was like Keaton. Nobody. Yeah.
Well, there was a film that he did, the college one. I think it might be called My College or Our College or something. And, it's so funny because he's supposed to be playing a wimp and he's just absolutely the most athletic little man you've ever seen.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Well, I don't think any studio would let him do that today. It's so dangerous. They couldn't afford the insurance on the feats that he does. They're just so outrageous and risky.
Absolutely. And the title of your book as well, having heard the title long before I read the book, I didn't realize how literal it is, that it really is, at the beginning, there is a sense of reverence. There is a sense of idolatry, of putting women on a pedestal to some degree. And then, yes, you hit the 70s and like you, there's nary a film without a woman getting raped.
Well, it's sort of Victorian. It is the Griffith, especially, but silent cinema is sort of Victorian and it's, so you're the sexes. And then, all of a sudden in the 70s, it was de-repression. You could show stuff on the screen that you hadn't shown before. The Hays office was no longer operating. And what happened was not that you got equal treatment or anything, because we still hadn't reached a point where women were supposed to take the initiative. I'm not sure if we ever will exactly reach that or whether we should, but anyway. That's another story. So this sort of misogyny was just sort of out in the open and explicit.
It does feel so, sort of punitive. It does feel like, okay, Diane Keaton, you want to be a teacher in New York, and this is what, and you want to have sex with different people outside of marriage. This is what's going to happen to you. And
right, exactly. And I think we're still living with that in a little bit,
Just to go back a little bit, but the pre-Hays, the pre-code days, I'm a Again, I think this was a little bit of a result of COVID and having the opportunity to go back and hunt up lots of films I hadn't seen. I had a little bit of a pre-code watch list that I went through, and those films were so interesting and raunchy and different. And even even like the Tarzan films, I watched a few of those and wow, they were so sexy.
I had to watch those, yeah. I know, they were just casually sexy. They were just what they were. Which Hollywood has never been again, I mean, now or ever, was cosmopolitan. Mm. You know, they were worldly. They weren't just naive and parochial and the way some films were, a way that sort of the Hayes office implicitly was, narrow and parochial and puritanical. They just weren't any of those things. And you sort of can't believe it. I think a lot of it is the European influence or the influences of outsiders who are coming into the film industry and who keep it. I mean, directors like Lubitsch keep it cosmopolitan for a while after the code, but he does it sort of in this clever, sophisticated way. And also, he was so good. I mean, he's just another one of my gods that I think he influenced other directors. He made it possible for other directors to be slightly sexy and racy and to see how to do it. I mean, like Billy Wilder said, I learned everything from Lubitsch. But so thank God for somebody like that who did have this sort of cosmopolitan influence. But yeah, I mean, you see these pre-code films, you can't believe it's the same place that's putting out the more puritanical ones that come later.
Feels like the chronology's all mixed up. You know, this should come after. Surely we should make progress and this should come after.
I know. We just sort of, it really regresses. The cinema really does regress after the pre-code era. Yeah. And the women too. The women are wild and fun and nobody seems to, I mean, it's just really interesting. You know, one of the things I've always sort of objected to, and it's become this kind of buzzword. I remember when I read, nothing against Laura Mulvey, but very smart woman. But I remember reading her essay about visual pleasure and narrative cinema, about the male gaze, G-A-Z-E, the gaze, which has now become a buzzword used everywhere. It's a sort of suggests a monolithic view of movies that men are always objectifying women. And my feeling is not only number one is that watching movies is such a complicated multiform experience. It's not just, you're not just identifying with your own sex on the screen. Mm-hmm. I'll identify with a man on the screen. A man can identify with a woman on the screen. The women also eat their parts, even after the code, in the 30s, and I would say in the different ways in different eras, but the women themselves had such authority and such spunk and such spirit that even when they were playing conventional women who got married and lived conventional lives in the end, they didn't feel conventional. They didn't feel like just objects. So I think that it's just a narrow way of looking at it. And it sort of puts men in the driver's seat all the time, which I don't think they are. And this is one thing I wanted to make it. I wanted to write in From Reverence to Rape. It was a polemic against the indignities or the lack of independence of women's roles in movies, but also to suggest how women kind of sort of subverted that in many, many ways too. So that it was a complicated, and there was a lot of ambiguity in it. It wasn't just male possesses woman, male objectifies woman. It was, you know, that line was just too monolithic for what movies were.
And like, so the role of the femme fatale is you know, can't be contained.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's just that sort of, I don't know, there's a way that sort of ideological neatness doesn't allow for the wildness of life and the exactly. experience. I mean, yeah. It's much more visceral. I'm sitting in a...
More visceral and more, it's more ambiguous. It's not, it's not just, yeah. I think that, and that's the trouble with ideology is, and I'm afraid it's persevered in various forms in film theory and in the academy, is it's not about aesthetics. It's about ideology and it's about victimology. It's just always seeing women as victim. And if we can't see now that women are if women are always to be looked at, what part do they play in that? Why are they always dressing to be looked at? You know, I mean, come on, you know, what part do they play?
They're engaged in the world actively.
Exactly.
And so when you come on to sort of the present day, and as you're saying, the present day, we to some degree, feminism has had its victories. But while at the same time, you do look around and you do see, well, there are more female directors, but there's no sense of parity. You know, we have Greta Gerwig doing a wonderful sort of commercial success with Barbie. But these are kind of exceptional figures rather than so how do you look at the industry and see what's going on at the moment?
Well, I do. I think the word industry is good to use.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's right there, because it's a corporate mentality, and you see it not just in movies, but throughout finances and all other kinds of pursuits, that are the top men are just more comfortable with men. I think that's also, there is a backlash against women, and you see this in the right wing. I think the wanting to go back to a time when women had babies and stayed at home. I mean, there's still a huge number of people who want that. So yeah, I think it's still an uphill battle, and I think this has always been true, that women have been on a shorter leash, and they have less latitude, so that when they do make a film, history is littered with the stories of men who failed at this and that, and then became great directors. So women don't have the luxury of failing. Mm. I think that's one of the problems. Men are just quick to say, well, okay, we can write this one off. So I think that's one of the problems. So it is happening, but it's happening gradually, and it's happening more in countries that don't have industries or don't have the kind of corporate set up that we have. I think almost every other country, France, you know, some of the African countries in Asia, women, well, not so much in Asia. I don't see too many women directors coming out of there. They're more patriarchal, I think, than we are. Anyway, so I think, yeah, I think it's just slow in coming. And I think for women also, I think women are divided. Women are ambivalent let's just start with taking the initiative in sex, because we were talking about that. I think they're very ambivalent about that. I think this is one of the reasons we have this whole trope of women going and getting wasted in a bar. And then, you know, so they want to feel feminine and want men to come to them to all of that. So they don't want to be the big boss. And yet you have to be the big boss if you're going to make a movie. It's a real sort of authoritarian position in a way. So I think well, that's one problem. Look at, and even Greta Gerwig has Noah Baumbach at her side. That's pretty good too, you know? Not to diminish what she's done. We won't get onto Barbie because I'm not a big fan of it, but good for her anyway. But yeah, she does have Noah there. Sort of, I don't know how much influence he has, but he's certainly someone to lean on. Yeah,
it's funny as well, because I think that thing of it goes into what we're talking about earlier, in that if you're having a battle, then there isn't much room for nuance. You need blunt instruments and hammers to hit people with. Then when you're looking at criticism, which is a sort of different ball game to the industry itself, you need nuance and complexity, and you know you don't want blunt instruments, you want your scalpels. And so, you know, from an industry side of things, people talk about diversity and inclusion and the Bechdel test and this and that, which are very good things to tick boxes with, but they're not very good ways of actually looking at films and seeing how films operate.
No, exactly. Again, you're applying political or ideological principles to something that's not that is art. Also, I think you have to look at the kinds of films being made in Hollywood now, too. I mean, so little that is interesting and independent is getting made there. What speaks to them is sequels and series, you know, and blockbusters. That's what I mean. The Barbie obviously speaks to that. I mean, I think it doesn't. I don't think it means that they're going to start making feminist films, but they're going to make films that maybe nod to feminism or something like this one does. It speaks to them on commercial terms, because it's a blockbuster, because it's gotten a lot of attention. So I'm sure they're trying to figure out right now how to do a prequel or a sequel. That's one of the problems. The kinds of films that are getting made now that aren't really cinema as we knew it.
Yeah, there is a sort of almost like when we were talking about women's films in the, you know, during the studio era, there might be a resurgence of that coming back in terms of things like, I don't know, the ABBA movies, and which are very aimed, you know, they'll have a sing-along version in the theatre, character. So that'll be, you know, specifically to bring in a female audience.
Yeah, they're picking up on some of the commercial assets that could appeal to women. Yeah, that's
but that, it's not really cinephilia at the same time. I must admit, when you were going over some of the countries and places where, you know, women are having maybe making a few more films, I think the UK is actually getting quite good at this. There's a fair few filmmakers who have come out of in recent years have come out of the UK, like Charlotte Wells, Joanna Hogg. There was one that I saw at Cannes this year called How to Have Sex, which was exactly about the topic you were talking about, the women going out, getting wasted and basically problems with consent. And that's by Molly Manning Walker, her first film.
I've written it down.
It's really good. It's a really good, it's sort of like a bunch of girls who are in their 16, 17 age group, and they go to like a Greek island town to just, you know, no parents, and they're just there purely to get drunk and have sex, and she wants to lose her virginity. And it very much skates the lines of what is consensual, what isn't consensual, what are the pressures everybody's, how can you do this safely when you're still kind of a child?
And that's the trouble, that's another thing that's so different from my day, is they want to have sex at such younger age, and they want to do it. There was one movie, I don't remember the name of it, didn't have wide exposure, but it was about a woman who is the same situation. She's not that young, she's just in her 20s or so, gets wasted and raped, and then what she's going to do about it. And she's tells her parents, and they're very sort of loving and helpful. But at one point, she's driving with her father, and he said, "Well, why do you do that? Why do you go to bar? Why do you have to go to bars and do this drinking?" She says, "Because I like it." So, I mean, they want to do that, and at the same time, they don't quite know how to put the brakes on, and there's no framework for it. I mean, when I came along, we were so repressed. We had, you know, it was called first base, second base, third base, that you could let a guy go, and it took a long time to get from kissing to petting, if ever. Mm. But if you, I mean, it was just such a taboo of having sex young. And of having it, of course, this was sort of, it wasn't pre-pill, but the pill wasn't being widely used or talked about exactly. Well, I don't know, not where I was anyway. Mm. But the idea of getting pregnant was just, I mean, your life would be over. So this was what chilled us, and maybe in a bad way as well as a good way. But we knew that men were going to do this. I mean, there was somehow this, the lesson that this is what men do because they're sort of environment, you know, evolution, and the evolution is programmed them to do it, is to have sex. And so we knew to, somehow it was our responsibility to keep them from doing it. And somehow that has shifted. I'm sure it's better in a lot of ways, but in other ways, I think women are less protected than they've ever been. You know, I think they've given, I don't know. I can't evaluate really whether they've given something up. I mean, how negative or how positive a thing it is. And I look forward to seeing this film. There was one, I can't remember the name of it. My memory's so bad, a couple of years ago by, what's her name? Emerald something.
Emerald Fanning?
Well, about the revenge, a woman.
A promising young woman.
Yes, that's the same kind of story of a revenge for that kind of a rape. A woman actually, I believe she commits suicide afterward or something. Anyway, I mean, it's a very real issue. And I think movies, I'm glad movies are dealing with it. It's just very troubling.
It seems to be, I mean, it's that thing that when you said earlier, you know, movies are universal. There is that sort of the fact that universality is in itself sort of defined. It's like one of those things that is sort of like, seems to be a neutral term, but actually must have some sort of predefining characteristics before it arrives, you know? Do you know what I mean? It's sort of like we're using it, but we really mean it looks like us.
I think that's true. I think I feel this all the time when I'm reading people, for instance, in these, I see a lot of these papers from Columbia Film School students about the kinds of heteropatriarchal late capitalist practices. And I think, I sometimes think, well, don't we see that we are inside this too? We're being shaped by I mean, we're not that we write as if we're somehow outside of the problem or the era that we're writing about, but we're in it. You know, we write in it. So I think it's very hard to sort of evaluate as if somehow in this kind of abstract way. Anyway, I don't know. I just think sometimes I feel like I'm so for better or worse, and usually I think it's for better. I'm sort of out of this particular race, and I don't know what's going to come of it. I mean, movies, there are going to be more and more movies about he said, she said, and of these things. And it just goes on. I mean, I thought about that with the Harvey Weinstein thing. Number one, he's one person. How many others are not getting caught, you know, and are not going to get caught and are going to be covered up and go back to business as usual? I don't know. It's a discouraging thing. And I think in some ways we were better off when society put these brakes on us.
I think I had a definite sense that we sort of, it seemed that so-called witch hunt that some people wanted to use that idea. Oh no, it's gone too far. What do we do? It seemed to stop very quick. It was like, oh, we've got him. That's it. He's done. No more, nothing more to see here. You know, it's all fine now. It's just like, what? Him and Cosby were doing it all and that was it?
Yeah.
And now you're writing this memoir. That must be an interesting place to be headspace wise, that you're going back into the past even as you're sort of seeing new things happening.
Yeah, it really is fun. It is. I mean, I acknowledge in some how much better, and as I've already said, I think the cinema scene is today. It's just so much more diverse, obviously. Even if they're not as many women as we'd like to see making films, they're making them, and they're making, and people are aware of them as filmmakers. So, I mean, it is interesting, though, how that is one area where, I mean, we had, as people have pointed out, we had quite a few women filming, not a huge number, but in early Hollywood, and how things regressed at a certain point in the 50s, maybe, you know, the 40s and 50s and regressed. So now we have to sort of invent the wheel all over again. But in the most respects, is so much awareness. But in a way, the trouble is, this is one thing that just occurs to me all the time, how I'll see films at the film festival that some of my friends who are not particularly, who love movies but aren't cinephile, will never see. They don't even know the names of some of these Asian directors, and never will. So there's a kind of fragmentation, and there's no common ground. On the one hand, you have Everything Everywhere All at Once is winning the Academy Award, and a lot of older people aren't watching that. And you have these fairly esoteric films from, you know, India or Asia, not even all that esoteric, some more than others. And so the cinephiles are seeing those and not even all the same. So we're just not ever having the same conversation. And that's what we had. What I say is it wasn't the golden age of cinema. It was the golden age of appreciation, where we were realizing that cinema wasn't art. Even American films were art, and appreciating them. And it was exciting. And American films that hadn't really been seen or appreciated were being brought forward and reassessed. And so all of that, and although there was a lot of disagreement, as well, I think in this book I was mentioning earlier about favorite films, I think somebody, maybe it was the editor, said that on 10 best lists, you know, critics would be in, still are in critics groups and end of year prizes. And some critic would have something on his 10 best films that somebody else would have the same film on his 10 worst.
Oh, that's brilliant. I love that. I love that.
It is. But we were still seeing the same films. I mean, those 20 films that were listed in those two guys, or however many more, were all being seen by the same people. Whereas now it's just everything is. And I think it's interesting that there's so much writing about starting in, I don't know what, September, about the Oscars. It just there are more people writing about the Oscars than are watching it. You know.
That's absolutely true in recent years. Absolutely. I mean, there are some entire sort of like, I think, well, Variety certainly has an awards editor, and yeah, most major publications will have an awards editor as who does nothing but write about awards. And it's
yeah, I know.
I agree with George C. Scott in this. You know, he was the only actor to sort of turn down an Oscar just because he thought it was rubbish. He didn't agree with the idea.
I'd forgotten that. Good for him. Like people that turn down the Nobel Prize. Yeah, good for him.
Yeah. He called it a meat parade. Not a nice man in other ways,
but
talking about that sort of canon of sort of one of the things that I always look back to is when I was growing up in the 1980s and I was having my first experiences of cinema, I could look back at the two decades that sort of preceded me that, you know, I had to catch up on before I could go forward. And there was just a very short list of names. It was Bergman, exactly. Kurosawa, Kubrick, Fellini.
Yeah.
You know, there were these, you get them in under your belt and you're in a pretty good position to argue with people. And
when I was coming along, we even were aware of silent cinema. I mean, that was what was, I say this, it's not quite true. It's a little exaggeration, but I say you could hold the history of cinema in your hands, which of course now it's just vast in time and in space. I mean, there's no way. And that's why I think it has fragmented. We have fragmented into generational kind of appreciations, because I think that the young people now have no, how could they have an interest in silent cinema unless they are really hardcore cinephiles? And the earlier films don't speak to them. I think they're just so overwhelmed with the now of the internet, everything that's going on and what's available to them, that they don't even maybe they don't even look backwards to out of curiosity. I was doing I was doing something on His Girl, talk on His Girl Friday out here, and some young woman called to do a pre-thing interview and said, well, is it relatable to young people today? And I said, you know, maybe not. You know, maybe Cary Grant, maybe they just could not even, and Cary Grant gets away with a lot in that, and he might not get away with any of it to an audience today. It's a different world. I said, maybe not, but maybe they would like to see something that's of their past. You know, when I was teaching, students wanted to know about the Depression. You know, I hadn't been in the Depression, but I knew about it from reading about it. And there were films that, I mean, like even Gone with the Wind, you know, these films that related explicitly or implicitly to the Depression. But I don't know if there is that sense of volitional curiosity about history now.
It's almost like we don't have anywhere to stand still for a moment to even, you know, I mean, I remember being bored for a week, and, you know, I was bored for a week in 1987, the rest of my life I've been doing too much, you know,
Exactly. And I think that's what everybody's thought of. I mean, it's terrible to say, but breathing a sigh of relief that no movies are getting made right now, because now we can look at the ones that we haven't had time to look at because of the strike. And COVID too was a chance to kind of regroup and watch things. I don't know. I think it's probably theater going is going to be a specialized thing from now on, with things like with Oppenheimer and Barbie. We'll get people in theaters, but not just regular, you know, openings. I don't know. So that's a whole different thing too. And also I think that's the series. I think it's always important to talk about series, because they've taken over in a way the storytelling function that Hollywood movies used to do. I don't think narrative is how, you know, it's all kind of, it's not just, not that it's postmodern, but most serious movies play around with time and aren't really, I don't know, David Lynch or whoever, they're not interested in sort of straightforward narrative. So I think the series, and some of them, as you know, as well as that, are just fantastic. So they've taken over that function a lot, I think. So, and they're the ones that people talk about the way they used to talk about the current opening, some movie opening.
Also, that's where we go to for characters, you know, I mean,
psychology, which most movie makers have turned their back on.
Characters the last 20 years are Walter White and Tony Soprano, you know, it'd be difficult to sort of point to a character in cinema with the same.
That's right. And they get to sort of create it over time. So Yeah, it's a golden age, actually, for character acting.
I've got one last question for you, Molly, which is a question I ask everybody on the podcast, which is I'd like to ask you to recommend a film book for our listeners.
Oh, wow. I want to just say before that how much I love British crime series. It's my favorite.
Ah, right. What are you watching at the moment? Have you got any particular ones?
Well, I loved Shetland. I was mad about it. I always just fall in love with somebody. I fell in love with what's his name in Shetland. My mind is going to go blank now because I still haven't had my coffee. But Douglas something and Henshaw. No, I don't know. I should have thought about it because I really, really love a bunch of them. Anyway,
Douglas Henshaw. Yes.
Douglas Henshaw. Yeah.
You know, I've not seen that one. I should watch that.
Yeah, I love that. And the others. Oh, I can't remember. I wish I could because I would love to just pay tribute to some of these fantastic actors. This is what it means to be old. The titles and names just elude you. Sorry.
Oh no, it's going to get worse because I'm already there.
No, you're not. You picked up on some of mine. Janine mentioned it. We just were asked to do the 12 or something best movie books, and so I had to make a whole list. I found that really hard to do because it depends. I put one of hers down on the list. I put Andrews, the American cinema, but that was sort of has a historical function. That was 1968 when he was, you know, bringing the Calier formulations to bear on American cinema. I just made a list.
It's so interesting making that list up because there's just so many different ways of approaching it.
I know. That's the problem. Things like Louise Brooks' memoir or the David Selznick memos, which I read, I put mostly ones that Kevin Brownlow, who's sort of indispensable.
He did a great documentary as well on Buster Keaton, going back to Buster Keaton.
Oh, I've got to see that.
It's on YouTube. I think it's called When the Circus Has Gone, or it's...
Oh, I've got to see that. Okay.
Or if you just Google Buster Keaton, Kevin Brownlow, it'll come up on the videos.
Okay. So also, I love one of the things the point I'm making in this book, it's about critics. And critics sort of I've always had a sort of a bad name, and I've never understood why, because I've always loved them, whether it was in English or, you know, literature or whatever. I love reading critics. And so there are a lot of anthologies with critics' reviews in them that I read, that some of them that came from this National Society of Film Critics, as Gavin Lambert. I mean, there's just so many who...
Yeah, it seems to be a thing that we need to defend nowadays as well, because there's, you know, people are kind of, in a way, more literate when they come to discussing their taste. And, you know, there are all these little phrases for tropes and things, which I never had when I was growing up. I just watched TV and quite just swallowed it whole, right, basically. You know, people will say, oh, they fridged that character. And I was like, what? They did what to that character? And there's I have to find out what that means.
What does it mean? That's a new one on me. What is it?
Fridging a character is usually killing off a female wife, relative or wife usually, in order to give a male character emotional depth. Something Wes Anderson does a lot, or, you know, or you'll have a Clint Eastwood in Dirty Harry, you know, he mentions his wife was killed by a drunk driver, a hit and run, and so it...
Oh, that's fantastic.
And it also has the sort of, I think, I didn't read this in the definition, but it also has the thing of saying, and they're not gay. They live on their own. They're men.
Right.
And they have a wife.
They're certified heterosexual.
Exactly.
Also, just to get the woman out of the way. I mean, they do this all the time in Hollywood movies. Some woman gets killed in the first thing, and then the man's on his own. I've never thought of it to give him emotional depth. I don't think they go for that in the movies that I'm thinking about, but it's just sort of to get her out of the way. She's sort of dispensable, you know, to get the action going. She's a sort of drag on the action, but that's a great term. I'll just say this book because I'm in it, because I can't think of one that sort of would prevail over all the others, but I'm not even sure what it's called, but Wes Anderson put out a book about Asteroid City, in which he has essays of all sorts of different people about the West. They're all about the West, and they have Kazan in there, and they have Kent Jones has a piece, and who else? They're all, I mean, it's all sorts of interesting pieces. I have one on the Billy Wilder film with Kirk Douglas, Ace in the Hole.
Oh, my God, what a bitter film that is. What a wonderful film.
It's the darkest film ever. So my essays, and then a whole bunch of other essays. And it's just an interesting book. And it has a picture of Asteroid City on the front. It just came out. I'm not saying it's indispensable by any means. It's a quirky kind of entertaining book, just like the film. It's not like the film. It has, you know, it has all these different people in it. And you just you go from one to another. It's sort of there. It's sort of this deadpan thing where one is against the other with no explanation, you know, no necessary links.
That sounds great.
Sort of a fun book. But no, that wouldn't be the one I would sort of recommend above all, except that I just can't think which one I would.
Well, that's okay. You have to come on again. And
Okay. There's so many, there really are. And I'll get my list out. If I'd known you were going to ask that question, I would have had my list at the ready. I can't even remember what I put on it now. That's how bad it is. But I did think about it a lot. And it was fun. It was nice because they sent you, I don't know if Janine talked about, but they sent you this like 6 pages.
Oh, I got it. I was doing it as well. I got this.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah.
So what did you pick? What did you pick?
Oh, I picked...
you put From Reverence to Rape on there.
Oh, obviously. Duh. Absolutely. That was the first one. That's the only one I put on there because that way it weights more.
Okay, go ahead.
I don't know what I put. I think I put Paul Cronin's book about Werner Herzog because I love Werner Herzog and I love the way Paul sort of brings out the most Herzogian of Werner. I put Otto Friedrich's City of Nets, which then Janine told me.
Oh, yeah, I love that. I didn't put that on, but I love that book. Yeah.
She sort of said, no, it's not. People, there's a lot wrong with that book. People love that book, but there's a lot wrong. And I was like, oh no. But it's such a great read. It's a little bit like, I think I might have put this on, David Niven's The Moon's a Balloon, where you know it's all bullshit, but it's so entertaining. It's so well written that it's... And then the others I can't remember. I really shouldn't say because obviously with the podcast, I've got 120 odd writers.
I forget the name of it, but Bud Schulberg. I don't know how true that is either.
I'll mention Run, Sammy, Run.
No, it's about Hollywood.
Is it called?
Yeah, okay. Maybe it is.
Sammy Runs or something like that. I guess so.
Here's an example of. I'll sort of take a deep dive into something. A friend of mine recommended a French. I wanted to write about sound because I'm doing a lot of audiobook. I mean, it sounds unrelated to cinema, but I love audiobooks because my eyesight is not that good. And I have a whole range of audiobooks to listen to, including British procedurals. I have a favorite there too. But he recommended this Michel Chion, who's a French critic who specializes in sound. And his classic book is Audio Vision, Sound on the Screen, which I've just gotten. I haven't read it yet. But I suddenly started reading something about Kubrick, and I wanted to look at Eyes Wide Shut again. And he has a monograph. I think it's one of those,
BFI.
BFI film monographs on Eyes Wide Shut. And it's just brilliant. And I'm not sure I agree with it. I don't think Eyes Wide Shut. I'm not sure what I think of Eyes Wide Shut. I sort of go back and forth on it. But I just loved reading that and then thinking about that and then seeing the film. So this is why I love critics. And I just would say this is why I have a hard time coming up with one book. But we will do that. We will revisit that, I hope. And I could just... blast off a whole bunch of them because I think that they're books that should be read. Okay.
Well, thank you so much, Molly.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. I'm sorry. I was kind of groggy, but thank you.
Okay. I'm going to cut the recording there.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
So that was my conversation with Molly. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did, as you can hear. It was a really interesting insight into a period and also just interesting to compare it to how things are today in the state of criticism, the state of thought and feminism that we are living through at the moment. All that remains is for me to thank Elliot Atkins, who did the music, and to thank you, dear listener, and to see you next week.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.